Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
You know his voice as the soundtrack to a footballing institution.
Here we go again. New season, new titles, new managers, new signings. But apart from that, nothing much has really changed.
You know his face, one that has evolved from that of a goal scorer extraordinaire. Double FWA Player of the Year, 1986 World Cup Golden Boot winner. To one of the most esteemed sports presenters this country has produced. You know about his most embarrassing moment on a football pitch?
Lineker up there, it goes over Moran's head, and Moran must have given Lineker a shove because England get a free kick.
It's the 1990 World Cup against the Republic of Ireland. He is feeling poorly, and he is, rubbing his backside on the pitch to get rid of the evidence. Imagine if Twitter was around then. You know he eats crisps, and you know his political views. But do you actually know the real Gary Lineker?
It's important to remember, of course, that when I played, there was no social media, thankfully. so that's been a shift. That's kind of given me a platform to use it normally for football reasons, but I've other interests in life, like most people do.
The man, the myth, the match of the day legend joins us to reveal all. We tackle the fuss about his wages, why he's so determined to help refugees, the cutthroat world of broadcasting, and his new talent of cooking.
I've been offered cookbooks and TV ideas and all sorts, but I keep saying no. I'd feel a fraud. I'm just I'm getting better, but I'm an amateur. But so we'll see.
I think I should start by asking the most important question, the one that everybody wants to know the answer to, that's been on the lips of the nation for years now. So Gary, why do you keep exposing us to Piers Morgan on our timelines?
That's a very good question, of which I don't really have the answer. But no, Piers is an old friend, and we have a little bit of banter, they call it nowadays, don't they? He's quite annoying sometimes, but he's actually also quite good company sometimes. So, and he's one of those, he's quite provocative, and he will try and provoke debate, and sometimes I agree with him and quite often I don't, but it's part and parcel with Piers.
You have a very big profile in general, but particularly online, where you're not afraid to say what you feel. Have you felt that developed throughout your career? Because when you're a footballer, you're often encouraged not to say anything at all and to not take a position, whether that be politically or otherwise. And even when you're a big personality, that's the case. But you're now quite comfortable and obviously confident to state how you feel, regardless of what the matter is.
Well, I think there are a number of things that change. One, you become more mature and work things out a little bit in what you believe in, what you don't, and perhaps get a little bit bolder in trying to use your platform, whatever that may be. It's important to remember, of course, that when I played, there was no social media. Thankfully. so that's been a shift. That's kind of given me a platform to use it normally for football reasons, but I've other interests in life, like most people do. So I share those, and there are causes that I, you know, fight for, like stand up for, like refugees, for example. I'm involved in a few charities, other charity things. Politically, I'm interested in politics. I've never tweeted who I've voted for at any stage. Obviously, I went with Remain in the referendum, but that was a different issue. But politically, I, you know, like everybody, we look, and some things we applaud politically, and other things we don't like. I'm not afraid to say where I stand on those things, but most of my political stuff is kind of a bit Mickey taking, bit of fun. But you know, we all have our interests, and social media is a thing where people can find out a little bit about you, and that's ultimately what it's for. It's a totally separate thing to what you do when you're working.
You touched on a few interesting things there that we can get stuck into. Firstly, you said you're fortunate that social media wasn't around when you were a player. Do you feel a bit of sympathy for the current generation who have to deal with this instant reaction to every mistake, whether that be on or off the pitch? Modern football, there is no grey area in it. You're either shit or you're the best thing ever. And players have to now live and try and succeed in this environment.
Well, the truth is, of course, all the players that certainly play in top flight football anywhere in any league in the world, well, certainly in Europe, you would say are really good players, and people fail to understand that. And I always talk to them when people start slagging off footballers that are playing, you know, even if they're playing for Liverpool or City or Leicester or Man United or whoever is your team in the top flight, and they say, he's useless. And I just point them back to the fact that most people played at school. If they take themselves back to school, and there was always the kid at school that they said we all thought he was the best player you've ever seen, and he was going to make it, and then, you know, it didn't quite happen for him, and he plays like non-league football, but he was really brilliant. They don't actually really comprehend how good you have to be to play at the top in football, particularly these days. This competition is extraordinary. So, you know, that's why I'm pretty supportive and rarely critical of footballers, is performances, because I've been there. I know how difficult it is. I know how good they are. They are so good. And you can tweet something really, really complimentary about a really brilliant player, and underneath it still get people that have no idea whatsoever how good these people are, having a pop at them. I am quite supportive of footballers. I wouldn't have particularly enjoyed, I don't think, being involved with social media if I was a player now, because of that negativity that's around it. I mean, to be honest, with me on Twitter, I get a degree of that, but I get a lot of it, but I don't look at the notifications side of it anyway. So occasionally one will spring up because somebody that I follow or so would have responded to it, but by and large it's best to ignore it, because there's a lot of nonsense, a lot of drivel.
Another thing you touched on there is that you have many interests beyond football. It's a bit weird in a sense how we always expect people who work in this industry, whether that be as a player, manager or analyst, to only like the game. And players often get criticized if they're into fashion or if they've got different hairdos and like to express themselves a bit. We don't ever say an accountant should stick only to accountancy. So why do we have this about football? Do you have any explanation?
You see the old stick to football thing that you always get. I think it's from generally. The thing is, I think by and large, the vast majority of people are reasonable and understanding and quite pleasant on Twitter. But it's the people you notice, the ones that are unkind and stupid. And telling someone like a mechanic or a plumber is on Twitter and he's telling you to stick to football when they're tweeting that, you'll see their timeline full of political tweets and football. I mean, if they don't get their own hypocrisy, well, I find that quite amusing, but it's, you know, there are only a few of those that do it, and they're just not really thinking it through.
You have been in the public eye for so long.
I'm old.
Yeah, well, you said it, not me. But have you felt that this is the time where your voice matters most, carries the most weight, can influence the most change? And is this the time where, I know we're talking about people being intolerant of views, but where there is an acceptance now that actually, if you have a platform, you should be using it?
It's a difficult one. I don't think my views are any more important than anyone else's at all. But I do have a large platform. So I try and use it. I try and use it wisely, and I try to use it for good. I think I've got a social conscience. I think I have empathy. So I try, you know, that people will disagree with me, and that's fine. I don't mind, you know, I don't mind debate. I don't mind people disagreeing. I don't understand abuse. Just because you have a difference of opinion about something, why would you hate someone unless there's good reason to do so? So, I try and use it for good. I don't, you know, I don't feel I'm, you know, more important than anybody else in any way, shape or form. I don't think my views are more important than anyone else's, but I will share my views, and obviously I believe in what I say and will stand up for it. And, you know, I try and fight what I feel are just causes. And hopefully if you can influence one or two people to jump on the right side along the way, then that makes me happy.
The former England striker was moved by the plight of Alan Kurdi, the three-year-old boy who drowned trying to make the crossing with his family as refugees to Greece, along with thousands of others. Lineker has used his profile to draw attention to the efforts to help refugees. Earlier this year, he attended a football training session for unaccompanied refugee children. And one of those who benefited from the charity he's supporting says its work has changed his life.
I was almost on the verge of becoming homeless. And this is where, you know, Refugees at Home came in. And it was quite important for me because it basically, you know, provided me with like a roof over my head.
We've seen a switch now where players feel more emboldened to stand up for what they believe in, whether that be political, religious, or whatever the case. But as I said earlier, players are conditioned to speak in cliches, to say as little as possible, to stay clear from anything that could be considered controversial. Do you think it's quite enlightening and significant that football is now more open to diverse voices, ways of thinking, and that it's veering away from this insistence that if you are involved in the game, you should only comment about the game?
I think it's great, and I'm really proud of some of our young footballers for the way they've spoken out about certain causes, you know, whether it's been racism, you know, where a lot of players have got together and helped things, you know, Raheem Sterling in particular, and Wes Morgan and Troy Deeney and others. And then you've got, you know, what Marcus Rashford has done, for example, in terms of feeding our poorest children, and what a wonderful example he set. And you've got to remember as well that these are very young men. Footballers are young men, and I've got four young men as sons, and by and large they're fairly daft most of the time, and the maturity comes late, and we expect a lot of our young footballers. And you know, I've got four kids all in their 20s now. Well, they're not kids anymore, they're adults, but and they can live their lives and they can have fun and they can go out. And for footballers it's a bit more different now. Obviously they're very well compensated. We all know that. They all earn vast sums of money, which almost makes them an easy target. And, you know, we saw it at the beginning of the pandemic, didn't we? When the government had a pot and said, oh, the footballers have got to do something. And they already were getting together to do something. And they've been brilliant throughout this crisis. And I think some of them have been really impressive, especially when you consider their ages. Yes, a few of them have made mistakes in lockdown and done things that they shouldn't have done. And, you know, obviously a couple of young kids with England a couple of weeks ago made a silly mistake, but they'll learn from it. And there's so much in the spotlight. It's not easy, especially when, you know, you're growing up. Kids of 18, 19, 20. I mean, we do expect a lot of them. And but they'll learn as they go on and they'll make their mistakes. But as long as they learn from them, then it'll be fine.
You touched on them earning a lot of money, which is something that is constantly held against them. And they're quite young having to deal with that. You, on the other hand, are very mature. You've been in this industry a long time. You're so set in your career. But you also have your salary thrown at you quite a bit. Despite all those factors, is it still difficult for you to deal with that?
No, I fully understand. I mean, it's hard for me to, you know, justify a salary for what I do, but I live in a business that is, you know, it's football is a global business. It's I've been lucky to be involved in it on both sides. It's very competitive, particularly in the TV world as well. You know, there are not many footballers that have gone on to presenting. I got a niche in that, and obviously I know that I've had offers where I could have gone elsewhere for more, but I've not, you know, I don't want to try and plead holier than thou and stuff. So I get it. It's understandable. It's a bit of ammunition to fire at me on occasions. But I totally recognize how fortunate I am, but, you know, I'm not going to sit here talking to you now and say that, you know, I deserve getting more than one of the nurses that's been on the front line. No, I don't. I know that, but it's, you know, I'm just very lucky to be in the business I am.
You don't decide.
No, I don't decide. And I obviously, you know, I've got a bit of criticism, I think, from in Parliament from Jacob Rees-Mogg about it the other day. I mean, this guy's got, you know, he's got his companies based offshore and all this. He's worth hundreds of millions, and the hypocrisy is quite baffling. But you kind of get accustomed to that. But it's a difficult one. I try and do my bit with it as well. So, and try and help a few people and help a few causes along the way. But I'm not going to sit here and argue and try and justify my salary, because I can't. I'm just lucky.
Well, Mr. Speaker, slightly warming to my earlier theme, I'm not entirely sure why a retired footballer is paid more than Vic Marks, a distinguished Somerset cricketer who regularly appears as an expert summariser on Test Match Special, and I would have thought is deserving of much more money than a retired association footballer. And I do think that the BBC has been unfair on pensioners in requiring them to pay the licence fee. The hope was that they would not do this, and they are basically stealing the Ovaltine from pensioners' nighttime drink by charging them for this licence fee, and they are losing licence payers. They've lost 250,000 licence payers in the last year, as people are voting with their feet. And I think the BBC needs to pay attention to what my honourable friend is saying, because when they're charging some of the least well-off in our society and giving the money to some of the most well-off in our society, there are people who will rightly question that, especially when they're not giving it to cricketers.
The plight of refugees is something you care quite deeply about. How did that come about?
I think it was primarily, we're going back, I don't know, what, three, four years, whenever it was, and we started to see images on the news of them having to flee war-torn countries, and then kind of in boats, and then there being, you know, a lot of kind of aggression towards them, and no one would take them, and you these poor families, and they're drowning off, falling off the boats. And there are a couple of stories that kind of hit me emotionally, and I just thought, imagine being in that situation. Imagine if it was in London, and suddenly we're all of a sudden with some strange regime, and we're all getting bombed, and we have this, it's impossible to live here, and we have to go somewhere, and no one wants us, you know. So I just felt like a massive amount of empathy towards this poor people with this dreadful plight they had. So, you know, I stood up for something, and then I got criticised for that. And I even got, you know, front page headlines to should lose my job because of having empathy towards refugees. And I thought, well, how have we got to that? How does that happen? And so it's kind of, and the more I get attacked, I'm kind of a bit stubborn and I'll go the other way. So I've supported a number of charities over in recent years since that. And since then, I've met loads of refugees. There's some brilliant football things going on. Fulham and Chelsea do something. Arsenal as well. I think Burnley have got a good thing. I think there's a lot of clubs around the country that do things with refugees. And I went to Fulham, which is just down the road from me, to their ground, and I, you know, met lots of them. They do football training stuff, and they're just really nice people. They're just like people that needed a little bit of help in life. And we have to do our bit. Now, obviously, we can't take everybody. We all know that. But we have to do our fair share, and that's all I feel.
A lot of issues, I think, today are flagged as political when actually, if we're being honest, they're humanitarian issues, and we should be looking at them that way.
Yeah, exactly. It was deemed as being a political position when it first started, and that's why they said you can't do that because you work for the BBC, even though the guidelines at the BBC are very much, in terms of social media, are you can't kind of give political preferences or go one way or the other if you're in news and current affairs, and I'm not in news or current affairs, so I can do what I want, obviously. But I also understand that there's a degree of responsibility in my position, so I don't think overly stupid. But you're absolutely right, the refugee crisis that the world is now facing is a huge humanitarian issue. It's not a political issue, or it shouldn't be a political issue. It should be all countries trying to just do their bit for humanity.
Goals, goals, goals. We've never seen a start of a Premier League season quite like this one, and it's fair to say we're enjoying it immensely.
It's so hard to imagine Match of the Day without Gary Lineker now, but there was a point where he couldn't imagine being a success on football's flagship show. We find out more about that after the break.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Okay, so you're not in news or current affairs, but you are on football's flagship show. I want you to talk me through being the face of Match of the Day, the spirit of Match of the Day, because I know when you first started, you thought, oh my gosh, how can I possibly do this presenting stuff? How can I be a success at it? But now I'm sure it's as automatic as breathing to you.
I've been doing it an awfully long time, but as you say, it was actually when I was on Football Focus that I used to drive home after doing the show and thinking I'm never going to be able to crack this. But you know, with time, you get used to the environment in which you're working in and you become more comfortable. Then you become yourself, and then people ultimately decide whether they like you or not. Now, not everyone will ever like you. You'll always have people that just can't stand you. There's something about you that irritates them for whatever it is. But as long as you've got the majority on your side, you've got more that like you than don't like you. You've got half a chance. But yeah, it took a long time. It's a great show to be part of now. I've been doing Match of the Day now for over 20 years as the host. And I always thought that's why I wanted to go into presenting. After I finished my career, I did punditry for a while, but I just thought if I could just crack presenting it, it will just give me an edge, give me above all the other presenters, because I'd be the only one that's played at the very top level in football or any kind of proper level in football, whereas all the others are just, you know, general sports presenters. But when I was playing in my late 20s, I used to look at like sports like cricket and golf and tennis, Sue Barker and David Gower, etc. They were ex-players that had gone into the presenting side of it, not just the pundits. So I just thought, no one's really done that in football. Well, Jimmy Hill did a bit of presenting, but he's primarily a pundit. Bob Wilson did it, but he's a goalkeeper, so that doesn't really count. But no one had done it that, you know, in my way. So I just thought if I could crack that, it would give me some kind of longevity in that position. And that's kind of how it's turned out.
That's some really tactical bits of thinking there. Well done.
Well, that's life, isn't it? It's about planning ahead, trying to anyway. And then, you know, you have your goals and then you try and accomplish them. Don't always reach your goals, obviously, in life, but can but try. On that one, it kind of worked.
You said it's a very competitive industry, which I know it is, especially in TV. So do you watch a lot of the competition? Are you seeing how they're evolving? Do you try and take away some things and make sure that you guys are at the cutting edge on Match of the Day?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, we do a lot of great television in this country. You know, look at Sky, BT, BBC, ITV. We do football. We do football pretty well. It doesn't kind of change that much. We have a very different audience on Match of the Day than, say, Sky or even BT, because the people that, you know, pay, you know, their considerable money for Sky and BT that they do, is because, you know, they're very passionate about football, almost anoraki. So therefore, the way Sky do it will always be a bit different to us, because they have like loads of time and they've got sports channels, lots of sports channels alone. We don't even have a sports channel. So our audience is really, particularly with Match of the Day and the obviously being a highlights package, and it's remarkable that it's maintained its audience considering how highlights don't tend to work as well in so many sports these days. We have to consider our audience is not anoraki. You know, it's not the ones that want 10-15 minutes of analysis. They want to see, it's their Premier League fix in the week, a bit of analysis, a bit of fun. Don't take it too seriously, but at the same time, you know, say what you think and show all the goals, all the games, and get off. We you can't be on for 3 or 4 hours and go into things in great depth. So we have to consider our audience are not necessarily complete experts. So we've got to try and help them understand what's going on.
They don't take it too seriously, but they do complain about the running order forever and ever and ever. Does it get old?
Well, I mean, the thing is, when we lost Match of the Day, I think it was about 2000, and we lost it for 3 years to ITV. When it came back, we were discussing what we should do with a new show, and I said, do you think it would be possible to show highlights of all the games? Because at that point, they used to be like highlights, proper highlights of 2 games, then you get short highlights of perhaps a 3rd game, and then all you get from the other 5-6 games, whatever it was the goals. And I said, is there a way we can do highlights of every game and then everyone will be perfectly happy? And they did. They backed it. And it was expensive to do that, but it offered a much, much significantly better service. But instead of all the fans going, "This is fantastic," I'm sure a lot of them did. "It's fantastic. We can see highlights of every game. We give at least 6-7 minutes to every single match." It's now, why is the team not? Why is that team? Why is our team on eighth? Or why are we on last? Why are we always on last? And the thing is, I would say, and then people say, "Oh, you're just so biased against my team." And I said, "No, we're not biased against your team. You're biased because you only ever complain about where your team is on." They never complain. They don't go, "Tell you what, Everton were a bit unlucky to be on fifth, not third this week. And they're a Liverpool fan." It doesn't happen like that. So, but it's not a serious complaint. I think most of them are just having a bit of fun with it. But it's kind of become a thing. and it's often they go, "Oh, we're always on last." I said, "Well, score some goals. Score some goals. You get yourself up the running order."
You've said score more goals to affect the running order. But I mean, all we've seen this season are goals. We've seen so many penalties because of the change with the handball law, some absolutely crazy results, some unbelievable games already. Do you think the strange nature of the season, the fact that it's going to be so intense with so many games in a short period of time, that there's going to be room for a few surprises? I mean, we've already seen them.
Well, we've seen one or two surprises already, haven't we? But we've certainly seen a lot more penalties. I mean, I don't mind seeing more goals and more penalties, but I think it's got to be kind of fair. I think they're messing it up at the moment. And even though there is a new handball law around, obviously there are going to be more penalties because of that. I think they're misinterpreting it as well. They're missing that key. I mean, I've read through these handball laws about 5 times already this season, and there's one clear bit that stipulates, which has not changed from before, that you have to regard close proximity, and they've not done that. I mean, there was the Palace one at the weekend, and then there was obviously the Tottenham one, and I just thought they're like so close, it's ridiculous because their arms in a certain. Where's your arm supposed to be? It's only connected to your shot. I mean, it's just got silly. There was a few years ago, I used to say, actually, I said, well, they might as well just make it. If it hits your hand, hits your arm, it's a handball, even if you don't mean it. And to be honest, it was kind of, I was just thinking out loud. A bit like they do in hockey, where they used to hit the feet and it's automatic. So at least players then would know where they stand and they have to get their arms out of the way. But at the minute, no one knows where they are. I don't think that's workable now because of VAR, by the way. This was pre-VAR. With VAR, they'd suddenly take that with this microscopic nonsense that they're doing and they'd say, if it flicks a knuckle, that's handball then. So you couldn't do that. But they're better off actually just going back to the old, it's got to be deliberate or deemed as deliberate. There will still, that's still kind of never absolutely clear, but there's never going to be anything that's completely clear. So I think they need to go back to the kind of that common sense, because we had the absurdity last season, didn't we, of the handballs when it was leading to a goal, even if it was, you know, 2 or 3 minutes before, whatever it was. They've adjusted that one to just if it leads to a goal, which is perhaps more sensible. But now they've brought this one in and they'll probably amend that at some point. But the thing is, the people making the laws, like David Ellery with IFAB and stuff, you know, they're not really football people. You know, I don't think the referee should be deciding the laws. They should just monitor the laws once they're in place. So, you know, we're kind of making a bit of a horlicks of it. And it's all exacerbated by VAR and this fact that they can go and look so closely at things that no one's even appealed for. But it's a bit of a pickle. But I'm sure hopefully in time it'll sort itself out.
We're talking about the newness in football, but in terms of the coverage of it, it would have changed for you quite dramatically as well during COVID. How did you deal with the initial lockdown period? And then when you guys did return to filming, what was different about it?
Well, it was very odd at the start. Obviously, football kind of stopped for a while. And then we were actually in the kitchen with Ian Wright and Alan Shearer. We were doing just a podcast, which happened just before lockdown. And we recorded 3 episodes in here. And we had proper cameras on it because they were going to promote it on BBC Sounds because it's a BBC podcast. So we thought, So we started thinking, what can we do? We need to put out something for the people because we can't leave them with Mrs. Brown's Boys or whatever it's called every Saturday night. So they decided to put the podcast on, which instead of Macedonia, it went very well and proved popular. So we carried it on from all of our front rooms. My front room here was turned into like a TV studio. And we were just doing things from distance. We did much of their day. But obviously, I'm missing sport. The hardest thing for me was just not watching sport, not necessarily working on it, but just having... I mean, since it's come back, even though there's no crowds and we're not pretending it's quite the same, we all know how important fans are to the game, but it's great to have some, you know, entertainment back and real sport. And I always wondered what people did that didn't like sport. And what is it? How boring, you know? How boring, like, you know, watching your team win at Man City 5-2. I mean, those sort of things, just magical. And then I switched over to cricket, and there was this incredible IPL game where, you know, they needed 51 off three overs, and they did it with three balls to spare. And that was like extraordinary cricket. So yeah, it's good to have sport back, and we need the fans, and hopefully it won't be too long till this nightmare's over.
Was it weird not to have your schedule dictated to by the games and stuff? Because that's what I found quite difficult. When you work in this industry, your entire life basically revolves around football, the press conferences, the interviews, the travel. And suddenly there's nothing. And you're like, what else was I doing? What do I do now?
I know. It's totally different. And just, you know, being at home and even the traveling that you wait, whether you're in the games or going to the studio. That's just really, really strange times. Work was entirely different. But you just have to make do. We all had to do our bit and do what we were told. And I fear it might be happening again, but hopefully not.
We've also seen during this period, like we touched on earlier, football really coming to the fore in terms of players on an individual level helping out, whether it be with the food banks, Marcus Rashford campaigning against the government, holding them to account over child poverty and child hunger. But I think what people do really want to see is the Premier League taking more of a lead in terms of helping the rest of the pyramid out. Where do you stand on that front?
Well, I think they've helped, but they'll probably have to help more. It's very worrying at the moment, the lower tiers particularly. I think, you know, obviously the big boys they'll get through it, even though they've all lost like untold amounts. But having said that, they're still pounding in on the transfer market, a lot of them. But I think that, you know, the lower clubs, it's lower down the tier, it's going to be really difficult for them, and they will need help. But hopefully the government will help as well. We know how football's treated generally politically. It's kind of, you know, used as a lovely bandwagon when England team does well and gets to the semi-final and you see the politicians all over it, but they don't do anything at all apart from those situations. And that probably applies to other sports as well. So we know how it works with politics, but I think it's so important to local communities right around the country. Their local football club is everything, and we've got to try and help them and protect their futures. And it's seriously worrying what might happen to a lot of clubs.
Jürgen Klopp was quite interesting when he said he doesn't know how the government is worried about what football's doing when, you know, they've got so much on their hands to worry about with the coronavirus crisis and the way they've handled this entire global pandemic, you know, the failure of the track and trace, the delaying. What are your thoughts on how they have led the nation through this?
Well, I think firstly, it's important to say they were dealt an awful hand to get this just after winning an election. And obviously, it's a situation that none of us have lived through before. So I think you have to have a degree of sympathy towards that situation. Having said that, I like many others, feel it's not been handled particularly well. There's been U-turns on everything all over the place. It just seems a little bit like they're reacting to things that rather than be proactive. Doesn't seem to be any kind of long-term plan, just ad hoc measures. But it must be intensely difficult. I wouldn't want their job at the moment for anything, because it's so hard, because none of us really know. None of us know what is actually what should happen. But there's no question that testing has been poor, that the track and trace system has been slow coming, and we've just been a bit behind the ball, really, and we've suffered, and a lot of people have lost their lives, and a lot of families have suffered, and it's been pretty awful, but can't be easy. There's no question about that, and I don't envy their position.
Okay, so we know you're very interested in politics. We know you're a dad. You love spending time with your family. You've got your production company. You've got your own podcast. But what is it about Gary Lineker that people may not actually know? What other hobbies or interests do you have?
Cooking is my newest passion. I mean, obviously, I've always been sportaholic. I've always played loads of sports and stuff, but I'm getting too old for all that now, but still work out. So working out a lot, keeping fit as much as I can. I read a lot. I love cooking. That's become my new passion, and I'm getting all right at it now. I started about, I don't know, 5 years ago when I kind of, when I got on my own again. And I went to restaurants on my own, and so obviously with friends as well. And then I was getting takeouts, and I just thought, oh, come on, get a grip, learn to cook. And actually, it was the best thing I did. I just love it. I love going out. I love going, getting the produce. I love prepping. I love the cooking, the timing. And then, especially when you're cooking for people or my boys or whoever it is, it just gives you it's quite satisfying. When it goes well, I love it. So I spend a lot of time doing that, and did quite a few things on Instagram during the lockdown. I posted a couple of pictures of food, and people said, oh, I want that recipe. Why don't you post the recipe? And I thought, really? I'm only an amateur cook. So I started doing that, and then and I was testing the water. I thought, am I being a bit busy here or what? And then they said, no, we love it. So I kept doing the recipes through lockdown until I start work again. So I might do one or two more if it happens again, but hopefully it won't.
It sounds like you should be getting the tweet saying, get back in the kitchen, not me.
Very good. Yeah, I've been offered cookbooks and TV ideas and all sorts, but I keep saying no. I feel a fraud. I'm just a very, I'm getting better, but I'm an amateur. But so we'll see.
Okay, so you're having a dinner party tonight. What is your dish of choice? What's your speciality?
I cook kind of everything now. I've kind of upped my game a little bit, and a few classical dishes and stuff, with fish and meat and stuff. But I think I'd have to pick one thing. I'd probably pick, it's kind of a starter. It's something that I loved when I was in Barcelona, when I was in Spain. Gambas al ajillo. So prawns and garlic, basically, in the juice and stuff. But they do it in a certain way, and I wanted to learn it, and I did it. And it's such a great dish that I'd probably go with that one. I mean, I'd have to follow it with something else, but it could be anything. But yeah, I'll stick with the gambas al ajillo. When you've got to cook the oil and get the shells and to make the juice, and then it's quite complex, but it's magnifique, or magnificos, I should say, if it's Spanish.
Do you enjoy cooking for yourself more or cooking for others?
Well, I experiment when I'm on my own, but I like cooking for others. I've generally got one of the boys here, or two, three, or even all of them, or four. I've got two tonight coming, then we're going to watch the game. So I'll cook first. And I don't know what to cook yet, though. I'm not giving it any thought. I'm going to go straight to the shops after this and have a think.
And wine to go with it, or what's your drink of choice?
I love my wine, particularly a good Bordeaux.
I think this is just going to become a wine recommendations podcast, because we had Maurizio Pochettino on sharing his recommendations.
A bit of Malbec, was it?
Yeah, Malbec.
Yeah, it might be.
He promised me he was going to send me some, which I still haven't received yet.
Oh, right, you see. Never promise anything you're not going to deliver.
Thank you so much, Gary. Enjoy the rest of the season with the endless games, the working, and obviously the cooking.
My pleasure.
Given some of the content in these pods, perhaps I should have called it Back in the Kitchen with Melissa Reddy. You know, just troll the trolls. I hope you enjoyed listening to Gary along with all the other episodes. Share some love on social media and let me know who you'd like to hear from as a guest. You can search for Melissa Reddy or Stakhanov and tell us your thoughts. Between the Lines is a Stakhanov production. Written and narrated by me, Melissa Reddy. Our producer is Charlie Morgan. Our assistant producer is Natalie Wilson. The executive producers are John Teague and Luke Aaron Moore. Sound design and mixing is by Tom Wally. All music comes courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.